Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org.
This is Judaism Unbound, episode 238, Jewish Women's Archive. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And as we continue this series that we've launched to coincide with the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote in America, we continue to explore the past contributions, the present contributions, and perhaps most importantly, the future contributions of women to Judaism here in America and all over the world. Essentially, we're trying to explore this question, which is a deep question that we've explored on Judaism Unbound all along, which is when you open the doors of Jewish leadership to people who previously were kept out, what happens? There's a story in the Talmud that we've talked about before, I think, on this show, and that I've talked about with B'nai Lappi on another show that we do called The Oral Talmud, where essentially early on in the history of rabbinic Judaism, they were keeping people out of the yeshiva, out of the house of study, the place where leaders were being formed. And the story in the Talmud tells us that when they decided at a certain point to remove the guards from the gates to let anybody in who wanted to study, the rabbis then in rabbinic fashion debate whether they had to add 400 benches or 700 benches. But the point is there were a lot of people who wanted to study, who wanted to contribute, who were being kept out. And what's interesting about that story is the very first thing they do when all of these students are admitted is they deal with a question about admitting other people. They look at a question of whether a person who comes from a different people, the people of Ammon, whether that person can be admitted into the congregation of Israel, can essentially become a Jew, even though the Torah explicitly says that an Ammonite cannot become a Jew. And the question is resolved in his favor. Even though the Torah says that he can't, they find a way to say that he can. And fundamentally, what we're exploring here is this question about when you open the doors to people who have been kept out of leadership before, what happens? And often the very next thing they do is try to let more people in. So in this series, we're exploring this question of a group that often is not considered a minority because it's actually a majority, but that has been kept out of Jewish leadership for much of Jewish history, namely women. And what happens when those doors begin to open? Last week, we looked at some of the history of Jewish women in America with Pamela Nadel. And this week, we are talking to the leader of an organization that, as women's contributions are made, they're going to be documented here. The Jewish Women's Archive is a national organization existing largely online, dedicated to collecting and promoting the extraordinary stories of Jewish women. Its mission is to document Jewish women's stories, elevate their voices, and inspire them to be agents of change. Our guest today, Judith Rosenbaum, is the CEO of the Jewish Women's Archive. She is an educator, a historian, and a writer who served for nearly a decade as the Jewish Women's Archive's Director of Public History and Director of Education before becoming the CEO. Judith Rosenbaum has a PhD in American Studies from Brown University, and she has been awarded a Fulbright Fellowship to study women's collective communities in Israel. I should note also that she is the host of an extraordinary show which we co-produce with the Jewish Women's Archive through Jewish Live, originally called the Quarantine Book Club, and over time it's evolved its name into the Quarantine-ish Book Talks, where extraordinary women authors are interviewed by Judith to talk about their work and their perspective. And it's just a really fantastic opportunity to learn and hopefully a valuable contribution during these times. We can't wait to jump into this conversation. So Judith Rosenbaum, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
I'm really glad to be here with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I'm glad we were able to pull you up from those dusty shelves in the basement of the Jewish Women's Archive. I mean, that's how it is, right? I wanted to start with that question. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Jewish Women's Archive is and what it's not?
Yes, absolutely. Always happy to provide clarity there. So the Jewish Women's Archive is a digital archive that is devoted to preserving and amplifying Jewish women's voices and really expanding the narrative of the Jewish people, right? Like here we are, we're a people, we talk all the time about history, about our heritage, about how important it is. We are constantly hammering that home. And in actuality, when we tell the story of the Jewish people, we're telling a very, very narrow story and one that leaves out all kinds of things, but certainly leaves out the voices of Jewish women. What we try to do is give access to Jewish women's history, Jewish women's stories and voices, and really center them in the way that we approach Jewish history and also the way we approach Jewish life today, so that we are drawing on the resources of the past to help us understand better the world that we're living in, how the world has been shaped, and where we're headed and how change is made. One of the things I like to say as a historian, I mean, I think Americans really don't get history very well. We don't teach it very well. People have a very dry sense of what history is. But history is the study of change over time. So what I always say is if you're interested in change, you need to be interested in history. We were founded in the mid-90s at the early days of the internet to really reimagine what an archive could be and make it radically accessible to people. So most of the time, people think of archives as not only kind of dusty, dry places of things that are crumbling and of minimal use, but also places that are really not open, you know, places that are meant for, that are sort of exclusive, that are meant for scholars and researchers and that are hard to get access to. And I think even some of us who are scholars and researchers have had the experience of having trouble gaining access to materials that are in archives. And we really wanted to democratize history and to give people a sense that this history is yours, it belongs to you, you are part of it, and you should be able to play with it anytime you want from the comfort of your own home and not have to gain access and dig your way in. So we want to be able to give people a way to encounter the stories of everyday life, to change the way that the Jewish story is told and make it accessible for people all over the world.
It's interesting because what you're saying is that the Jewish Women's Archives is actually probably one of the earliest Jewish digital projects, major Jewish digital projects. And I think we usually think of it as the category of women, but it's actually interesting to think of it as the category of digital. I'm curious, when it was founded, what was the driving force behind the founding of it? Was it a sense that now this digital technology allowed the kind of access that you're talking about and would provide an opportunity to elevate our knowledge of Jewish women's history? Or was that just sort of a happenstance that it happened at the same time? And what was really driving the founders?
So we were founded in late, sort of incorporated in late 95, really founded, I would say, in early 96. And really early, I mean, there was some discussion in the very early months of being more of a physical place. And I think early on, there was this sense that if we're talking about access, why would we not make use of the internet? If we really wanted to have the kind of impact that we were imagining, which was not just making sure that there was some scholarly projects going on and that things were being preserved, but really focusing on the access piece and the accessibility and making sure that the work that was being done, the scholarship was really impacting the community more broadly. And by the way, not just the Jewish community, but also the history community, making sure that when women's history was being taught, it also included Jewish voices. There was a sense that there was this was an opportunity to reimagine what an archive could be and what it could look like. So yes, and it has changed over the years. I mean, our early projects happened before Google. So like one of the early projects was what we called the virtual archive, which was basically sending people into different archives where we knew there were papers by Jews and Jewish families, where we suspected buried in those archives were materials by Jewish women. Often one of the challenges of women's history is that it's hard. First of all, much material has not been preserved. And even the stuff that's been preserved is very hard to find because it's usually it's like buried somewhere in someone else's archive, in someone's husband or father or son or uncle or, you know, something like that. And so often we don't know it's there. And this was in the time before you could just, now you can Google and if a finding aid is online, it will come up and you'll be like, oh, great, that library has this material. But there weren't finding aids and there was no, I mean, there were finding aids, but they weren't online and there was no Google. So we were basically creating that database. Once Google was created, that database became less relevant. And we transitioned it into other kinds of projects and it became the basis for, you know, various profiles and other resources that we have on the site. But we've needed to be very nimble over the years to respond to new developments in technology. And one of the ways that we're trying to do that now is really in the democratizing of history to engage the public as our partners in collecting stories. And we've put out a story collecting app that helps to make that possible. So that's one of the newer ways that we're trying to use technology to build our collection. you know, one of the things I would say about our work almost 25 years in is that there was always a very strong social justice component to our work. I mean, our work has always been political because saying that women's voices matter and that women's history matters is a political statement. But I think we've made that piece of our work a little bit more explicit in saying that, you know, the reason why this history matters is because it changes the way we understand the world, and it helps us all understand ourselves as historical agents who have a history and responsibility to be making history in our own lives.
So I really want to underscore the point you made about how one of the original purposes and continuing purposes of JWA, of Jewish Women's Archive, is to democratize history. And I want to talk about what that means. I also want to talk about a term that is coming up more and more in, like, I don't know, scholarly academia circles, which is public scholarship, which might be a newer term for some people out there. But basically, it's the idea that, like, people are learning and researching all sorts of cool things, and it's important for that those things not to just live in scholarly journals and academic conferences. It needs to get out to the world. And a little autobiographical moment. Like, sometimes people ask me to get a better sense of what we do with Judaism Unbound. Like, okay, so help me out, Lex. What are some organizations that you're sort of similar to? And it's a very hard question to answer. And one axis of answering that question that I've sometimes gone to is actually to bring up JWA, because I think there's a way in which, not in content, like we're creating different kinds of things, but we are also trying to, like, transgress a boundary between scholarly circles, quote unquote, and, like, the Jews, in quotes, that I think you're also tackling. And so I'd really love to talk, like, we could easily just skirt right on by that point that, like, okay, so you're a project that makes Jewish history accessible, that makes Jewish scholarship accessible. But, like, that's wildly important. When people ask me to learn about, I mean, this happens very regularly. Somebody has a question about whether it's an Emma Goldman or a Bella Abzug or whoever. And my first step could be like, ah, here's a scholarly book or article about that. My other step could be sort of, there's lots of, like, public facing museum materials or like pop history kinds of things on those people. But I tend to go to JWA because that's a place that really does its homework and really captures people's stories effectively, but it does so in a way that is understandable, that isn't jargony. And so I'd love to hear, like, what goes into that and a little more about, like, why do we need organizations filling that role for Jewish women's history, for Jewish women's today, now, and also just generally in the scholarly versus public divide.
I'm so glad you said all that, because I care very much about that public history piece. And it's very much a part of my own story of how I ended up in this work. Like, I have always really been interested in Jewish history and in feminism and in Jewish community and pushing its boundaries. And when I was in graduate school, I was studying women and social movements mostly. And I started to just feel this, like, cognitive dissonance around studying activism while sitting in a library and talking about it with a very small group of people, and feeling like, if what I'm studying is really about how change happens, like, why would I want this to be such a narrow conversation? It doesn't really make any sense to do it that way. Like, I wanted everyone else to understand why this mattered so much and why it was so important to me, because it wasn't just important to me as an intellectual endeavor. And in fact, when I was working on my dissertation, and my dissertation topic was about the women's health movement in the 20th century, which actually is a very Jewish story, although I was trying at that point, I was very resistant to being a Jewish professional, was trying very hard at that point to stay away from the Jewish story. So I always joke that my dissertation has, like, a shadow side, which is a totally Jewish side that I didn't write. Maybe someday I'll get to that piece of it, but probably not. But I specifically picked a topic for my dissertation that was something that, if you followed the news, you would be able to talk to me about my work, because I felt like I am not going to survive graduate school if I have one of those topics where when someone says, what are you writing about? And I give my little spiel, it's like a conversation ender. I was like, that is not how I want my work to be. I don't want it to be just like people have no idea what the next question would be because they don't even understand what just came out of my mouth. I felt like the only way this is going to work for me is if it opens up a wider conversation, because that's why I care about this. So when I came to JWA, it was such a breath of fresh air because I felt like, oh, this is a project. And I came in for the first time in the summer of 2000, started working at JWA. So it was in the early years. And I felt like this is a project that's all about this question of how do we take the scholarship that's beginning to happen and make sure that it doesn't just stay in the ivory tower? How do we make sure that it's really changing the way we understand the world? Because that's the whole purpose of this. Like, we believe in centering women's voices, not because, like, sure, women should have their due, and here we have one version of history and here we have another version of history. It's that it changes the whole thing. It's not just adding women to the story and like, okay, now we have a bigger story. It actually changes the story. And one of the things that happens because we're online is that now Google last year said we were in 232 people in 232 countries were looking at our stuff. Now, I don't think there are 232 countries, but the way Google counts it, there are apparently. But that means that when people in Chad or Kyrgyzstan are Googling things and our material comes up at the top of the list, the entry point they have to Jewish history is through Jewish women's stories. That is like kind of mind-boggling and very radical because it would never have happened even 25 years ago. And one of the stories that's part of JWA's origin story is that our founder, Gail Twersky-Reimer, was at a big Jewish communal conference. I think it was a general assembly of the federation system, and went to a panel on Jews and social justice. In the course of this panel, at which many wonderful Jewish social justice leaders, male leaders, spoke, they didn't mention the single name of a Jewish woman. And so Gail went up afterwards, the person who was organizing the panel, who was a well-known figure, and said, how could you talk about Jews and social justice and like never mention a woman? Like, what about the labor movement? What about feminism? Like, what about peace activism? Like, what? How is that possible? And he said, I don't know those stories and I don't know where to find them. So part of the founding myth of J, or not myth, but, you know, founding origin story of JWA is like, okay, well, I don't want anyone to ever be able to say that again. If someone tried to give that answer, we'd say, well, you didn't use Google. You didn't look at JWA, right? Like, it would be impossible to do research now and not have those things come up in your first cursory Google search. Even then, I would say it was a little bit lame. It meant like not looking for new books, but okay. So maybe not having access to a library where those things were being highlighted. So we definitely see our work as public history work. And actually, I'll say that when I first came to JWA as a full-time staff person, my title was Director of Education. And I quickly changed that into Director of Public History because I felt like it was really important for people to understand that the nature of our work was public history. It wasn't just about making sure that things were preserved and documented somewhere and we didn't care at all if people used the material, which is, you know, not to denigrate archives at all, but most archives are just concerned with preservation. They're not really worried about, are people coming in the door and using the material and how are they using it? I mean, the good ones maybe are, but we really want to make sure that it is getting out there and changing the way that we're teaching and that we're, you know, the sermons that people are giving and the things that people are studying in other countries about who Jews are and what Jews do.
So can you help orient us a little bit about how we ought to be thinking about Jewish women's history? I think about it like, I think the answer, I'm sure, is all of the above, but especially when we're thinking about it in terms of perhaps, I feel like who said that, you know, something about a useful history, like a usable history, that the idea that when we're doing history, particularly outside of the academy, it's not just because we're interested in these stories, it's because we think that these stories somehow advance things that we're trying to advance today, whether that's social justice understood as larger social movements or social justice understood as simply the continuing taking by women of their rightful place in society. But how do we look back on history? Because I know that there are different ways, and I've heard it from different historians, that sometimes when you talk particularly about women, for example, it'll be like, well, history was not taking seriously enough the fact that not all history is by great men and whatever, and that there are all kinds of other history that happens in the home and in various other provinces that were historically the provinces of women. I mean, that's one piece. And then again, my question there is like, okay, and then what should we do with that today, right? And then there's, well, every great man had a mother and sisters. So, you know, there's something to understand even in the history of men that women were playing a role and that's important to understand. And then what do we do with that? And then third, and also extremely significantly, like there was actually a lot of big things that women did throughout history that for various reasons were not emphasized or the women's roles were de-emphasized intentionally. And that clearly, you know, it's clear what we ought to do with that. So I'm curious how you would kind of orient us. I know it's a big question, but orient us towards thinking about history from the perspective of thinking about women's history. How should we be thinking differently?
One of the things that happens when you look at women's history is you recognize that, yes, there are all these areas where women sort of the traditional spheres for women that have been undervalued, and we need to pay attention to those. And when we do that, it also changes other things. As you know, as I said before, when you center women, it changes our whole perspective. So I think in terms of, to make a connection with some of the work that you guys do, when we think about one, and I think this is one of the insights that feminism has given us about Judaism, is that when we define Judaism as what happens in a synagogue, you get one particular slice of what Jewish life looks like. But when you look at Jewish women's spirituality and Jewish women's life, you realize that there's been an enormous amount of creativity and experience that just is not captured by what we traditionally understood of as Judaism. Now, some of that is lost, but some of it has been rediscovered, things like Tchinas, women's petitional prayers that were written in Yiddish, and that covered all kinds of things from, you know, a prayer when your baby loses his first tooth, to a prayer for a miscarriage, to, you know, a prayer for a stepmother who's having a really hard time dealing with their stepchildren, right? So like all kinds of things that did not fall into the category of religious life and practice that actually women have been developing for hundreds of years, thousands of years. So there are the kinds of areas that you would think to look because we know, okay, women were, you know, in domestic spaces. But the truth is that women were also in all kinds of other spaces, sometimes in ways that were acknowledged, but a little bit written out. I also think right now, I would say we need to look at every piece of received information we've been told about things that men did and assume that there's a great likelihood that some of those things were done by women, and women just, not just women were behind the scenes supporting the men, but that actually women full on did them and a man's name was added to the book or slapped on. And it, pretty much it was written by a woman who was, you know, maybe was thanked as typing it or editing it, right? I'm thinking of like Henrietta Zold and Louis Ginsburg, right? Legends of the Jews, which now it seems pretty clear that she probably wrote a lot of that book. There are a million examples of that. The other thing I think is really important from a Jewish history perspective to think about is sometimes when we think about Jewish history, we look at only at what happened kind of within the Jewish community and think of that as Jewish history. There are many women who could not gain the kind of access and power and authority that they wanted from the Jewish community. And so they left and they did amazing things elsewhere outside of the Jewish community. And that story has been lost to Jewish history because it was seen as being somehow, you know, somebody who did not want to be part of our quote unquote community. So I think that's another place when I think about Jewish women's history, particularly, that is really important to look, to not only look kind of within the boundaries of the Jewish community, but beyond. There really is no piece of human experience that women haven't been involved in some way. And that when we try to kind of create a narrow sense of like, well, where does Jewish women's history live? That is never going to contain the fullness of it.
I mean, one question that I have that relates to this is a question about if to a large extent, and I guess my question is whether this is true, but I mean, it strikes me that a lot of women's history up until recently in the world, and certainly in Judaism, was what we often will talk about in Judaism as an oral tradition, that it wasn't really written down in books for whatever set of reasons, and it was passed on from mother to daughter and also to sons, and that when there are various disruptions, including but not limited to the Holocaust, the immigration to America, Zionism, that for various reasons sort of reach back into an older part of history to pull forward, right? That, and if it's an innovation, then you can say, well, women are part of it from the beginning. And in many cases, that's true. But if it's trying to claim a continuity, then it's basically reaching for a text. And almost by definition, that might mean reaching past women. And I'm wondering if there's a way to think about that, if there's a way to almost think about how to do a corrective to some of that, or is it really that just a tremendous amount of women's history is lost? And really what the response, you know, I guess in a lot of our questions, a lot of my questions at least here are kind of, and how do we respond to that? And maybe the response is to say, well, maybe history can't do everything that we want it to do, but we can acknowledge and have to acknowledge that that history existed and is lost. And therefore, all the more so should women today be empowered to create a new history.
I thought you were going to ask a slightly different question, which is one of the things that I struggle with, which is sometimes I think when we have that impulse to go back to traditional texts, there's this idea that we can use that as the replacement for actual women's history, right? So sometimes, so one of the things that drives me nuts is that some of the most visited pages on our site are materials around women in the Bible. I think it's great that people want to study women in the Bible, but you know, part of why JWA was founded was so that people would understand actual real living, or at least one-time living Jewish women. The women in the Torah are great, but they're myths. They're mythological characters, at least from my perspective, who we can use in lots of interesting ways, and we can learn a lot of wisdom from their stories, but that's not the same thing as actual people who lived. And I think it's easier sometimes to go back to the myths, and Jews like to do that a lot. And then people like to say like, oh, we're totally a feminist tradition because we have, you know, Deborah was a judge in the biblical period, so we're so egalitarian. We were ahead of our time, right? And Miriam was a prophet, and who, you know, a female prophet. Look how amazing we are. Jews, go Jews. And it's like, great. Those are two people in texts that have hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people. So it's very frustrating, I think. And it's a way of eliding what is difficult about dealing with actual people and their stories, which are, you know, we'd like to turn our real living people into myths as well. And often it's harder to have that material at our fingertips. So I long for the day when I look at the top 10 visited pages on our site and there are no biblical women and there are no stories of the Holocaust. That's the other thing. It's all biblical women and stories of the Holocaust, because that's what people like.
I also hope that day comes soon. I want to dive deeper into the point both you and Dan have made about how to not talk Jewish women's history is actually to not talk history. It's to not talk women's history. And I want to cite one of the quotations that I hate most in the world that gets said to me regularly, because I promise this will lead somewhere, but I give regular talks about Jews and sports, Judaism and sports. And almost every single time I do so, I get a comment either before the event or in the event itself from somebody in the audience who quotes the movie Airplane, this famous quote where somebody says, here, can I have some light reading? That somebody on an airplane, and the stewardess says, sure, here, take this pamphlet on Jewish sports legends, with, of course, the joke being that there aren't Jewish sports legends. I want to back out for a second and unpack. First off, there's lots of Jewish sports legends, but part of what leads us to the conclusion that there aren't very many.
There are even female Jewish sports legends.
Well, that's where I'm going. That's exactly where I'm going. So part of why people think that there aren't Jewish sports legends, there's many reasons for that all over the place that I could rant about forever. But one of the main reasons is that people don't think about Jewish women sports heroes. Any reasonable conversation about the best Jewish athletes of my lifetime is actually like exclusively or close to exclusively a conversation about Jewish women. Like if we're looking at people who have excelled to the highest degree between 1990 and now, which is my lifespan, the top athletes would be people like Allie Raisman, who, because of her center stage in gymnastics in the Olympics, people do actually have a sense of who Allie Raisman is. It would talk about Sue Bird, who I think very few people have heard of, but is by any reasonable count, one of the best women's basketball players of all time. She's an 11-time WNBA All-Star. She's very awesome. And it would include people like Dara Torres, who won her first Olympic medal in 1984, kept winning Olympic medals, not just making it to the Olympics, until 2008, excelling at the highest level in swimming on either the men's or women's side is deeply challenging, and very few people at age 40 have ever done it. She's the oldest woman to ever win an Olympic medal. Like, these are people that are the top of Mount Rushmore in Jewish athletes, but they're pushed aside for folks like Ryan Braun, who has steroid allegations as a huge part of his professional sports career, for people that are sideline characters on their teams. Maybe, you know, the fourth or fifth best player, but it's in Major League Baseball or it's the National Basketball Association. So we talk about them more than we do the WNBA. That's my rant in this conversation. I'm curious if you could help to identify other realms of Jewish experience where you could give us some specificity to this. Like, who are some of the people we don't know about who actually, if we had any reasonable account of Jewish history or even Jewish contemporary reality, we would be talking about way more and understanding way deeper?
I would say I can't imagine that people would teach the labor movement without talking about Jewish women, for example. But I think it does still happen. That seems like the lowest hanging of fruit to, you know, to think about a place where Jewish women's history actually is like American history, and you really can't teach it well without including those stories. But I do think that that does still happen. I think it happens also. I mean, I am still noticing this in coverage of the civil rights movement. There's a lot of work to be done there. We still haven't really moved beyond Heschel as being like the only person we talk about when we talk about Jews in the civil rights movement. But as with the history of the civil rights movement in general, where women's stories for a long time were sort of buried because of the roles that they were shunted into, that is a place where I think we have a much richer understanding of civil rights being something beyond, you know, giving big speeches and marching. And what the day-to-day life of actually making change on the ground, what that looks like. It's very hard to tell that story without talking about Jewish women. So certainly social movements like across the board, I would say, are like also the peace movement, right? Like I think one of the problems we have in the US when we talk about peace movements, often we're very focused on the anti-war movement, right? Which was very much focused around men resisting the draft. But before we get to Vietnam, there's like a century of peace activism that is very much led by women, and Jewish women play an enormous role in that, not only in the United States, but around the world. So I'm thinking, for example, of a woman named Beatty Sarada Gordon, who basically wrote equality into the post-war Japanese constitution. She was a young woman. She was 22 years old, living in Japan, and she was working in, you know, diplomacy and working as an interpreter. And she ended up getting involved in helping to really shape the constitution in Japan. Now, when we think about diplomacy, when we think about international relations, when we think about Jewish women's roles in these kinds of places, we don't think about people who are working in the 40s in another country. I think most people would say that doesn't sound like something Jewish women were doing then. But I think often we have just too narrow a focus on where Jewish women must have been and what kinds of roles they must have had. And again, these might be areas where, yes, you might guess that women played a role, but we may not understand Jewish women's particular involvement. So I think about public health as being one of those, and one that's worth thinking about now and in these pandemic times. You know, and it makes sense, right? It's connected to immigration, it's connected to urbanization, it's connected to a sort of larger sense of bringing that like maternal caretaking attention to society more broadly. The idea of sort of municipal housekeeping is what it was called. But it's not hard to imagine why women played important roles in those areas. But I think there are really interesting questions about that. I think about this in terms of my own work around the women's health movement. Like, why is it that the women's health movement is so enormously populated by Jews? I think there is a question there, not only around, I mean, Jews certainly play a really prominent role in feminism, and women's health is really connected to that in the second wave. But I think there's also something around Jewishness and bodies that isn't fully explored. And I think one of the things that happens, and this has to do particularly with the history of feminism and maybe the history of social movements more broadly, is that because often the Jews that we're talking about, the Jewish women we're talking about in those areas are white Jews, historians who have studied those topics who are not looking for Jews in particular miss the Jewishness of those characters entirely and just see them as white and don't further explore what actually their identities were and their backgrounds were. And so you sometimes will see books where the ethnic backgrounds of other white characters might be mentioned, but Jews are not identified as Jews. And so there's really a story that gets missed there too, because that story brings in a lot of things around politics and whether people grew up in a political family. It brings up all kinds of nuance to story and texture to story that is missing. And I think some of that work still really needs to be done. I don't think it's been fully explored.
I think even those of us who aren't that young anymore kind of grew up in an age where that there were a lot of women in positions of importance in the Jewish community was taken for granted. Now, not necessarily ultimate importance, but certainly all of the teachers were women. Then, and when we talked with Pam and Adele, like, that wasn't always true. I mean, like, that was kind of a revelation to me, the idea that Rebecca Gratz kind of was the source of this idea that women would become Hebrew school teachers. But, you know, in my life, that's everyone who's a Hebrew school teacher almost, you know. And I actually, we were laughing about a story that happened not too long ago with the daughter of a friend of ours who, when her synagogue got a male rabbi, she turned to her mother and said, "I didn't know a man could be a rabbi." And on the one hand, it sounds like a nice story. And on the other hand, there's something still profoundly wrong, because women are not in many of the senior leadership positions in the Jewish community. And like you say, not that long ago, there could be a panel that never raises a woman in terms of talking about social justice. And so I suppose, like, I'm curious about both some of the historical events that really were breakthroughs in the last 50 or so years, and also, one way to ask it is, why do they not fully succeed yet? But that's the question about feminism in general. I suppose I am interested in whether there's a particularly Jewish dimension to that story, or whether really it is that the Jewish community is mostly tracking the story of feminism more broadly. But could you open up that area for us?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think about this a lot. I mean, I think some of the challenges, the ongoing challenges in Jewish feminism, actually come from its success. So sort of what you're talking about, like, there have been so many contributions of Jewish feminism, you know, to liturgy and song and ritual that have been so deeply integrated into mainstream liberal Judaism that they're no longer recognized as feminist in origin. And they're just sort of seen as like, oh, that must be how it always was, like as if Debbie Friedman came to us from Sinai, right? And also, change has happened so fast that I think a lot of young people, or even not so young people, don't realize that women couldn't be rabbis a generation ago, or that their mothers might not have had a bat mitzvah, or at least not one that looks anything like theirs. And on the one hand, and it's interesting, when I talk to people about this, sometimes they say, well, isn't that a good thing? Like, don't we want people to grow up feeling like, of course, this is their birthright, and not to know that there ever was once, you know, a time when women didn't have these things? And I would say, as a historian, I feel like it's actually really important that people understand how change, they have to understand how things were to understand how change happened. And if we lose the story of how change happened, we're impoverished in terms of thinking about how to continue to make change, right? You need to have that that lineage and be able to build on it. I think also because there is now more of a widespread representation of women in particular roles, like rabbis and cantors and Hebrew school teachers, that it's created this incorrect impression that feminism has completed its work. And so I often hear from people, educators, rabbis, people I was trying to bring resources from JWA to, who would say, oh, I don't really need to teach about women in our curriculum because our rabbi is a woman. So we're good, right? As if like having one woman up there who, P.S., is paid not what her male rabbi in that position would be paid and has no maternity leave, we're all set because of that. So I think that sometimes those visible changes conceal the underlying lack of inequality and give us something to feel good about, and then not explore deeper or make deeper change. There are a few things that I like to talk about when I talk about Jewish feminism. You know, I think one of the things that is interesting when we look at efforts at Jewish feminism in the, you know, what we would call second wave feminism, so, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, is that it really begins with questions of access, and only then later moves to something that is really more focused on transformation or revolution. I think that there are still a lot of people who are kind of still stuck in this kind of liberal feminist mindset that if we just give women access to some leadership roles, that that's enough, right? So letting women be rabbis or run an organization, that takes care of it. But then we'd miss that next transformative step. And I think this is understandable both from a kind of comprehension piece and from a strategy piece, right? So I think the comprehension piece is that people are, you know, sort of assume like it's enough to just add women to the story, right? And this is sort of what I was talking about in the beginning about JWA. Like, I think the initial piece of women's history was like, let's just make sure that women are populating the history also. And then suddenly there's this awareness that, well, when we do that, it actually changes the whole story. That's the kind of piece that it sometimes takes a little while to realize that. I think on a strategic level, sometimes also it's easier just to say, and I'm not saying that women lied about this, I think it's a slow process of kind of growth, but you know, sometimes it's easier to say, I don't want to change the system. I just want to learn Torah. right? I'm not saying I want to shake anything up. I just want to buy in. Just let me buy in a little more fully. I'm totally with you. I'm not trying to change anything. Just let me sit in the Beit Midrash, you know, and let me sit in the study hall and have access to these texts. But pretty much all the time, once people have access to the texts, it's not enough because you're like, well, now I have access to the text. I know what you know. So if I know the same thing as you know, then why can't I be the figure of authority here? Why can't I be making halakha? Why can't I be the rabbi? Why can't I have this role if I know how to do the thing? It was one thing to say I couldn't do it because I didn't know how to do the thing, or women can't learn how to do the thing. Once I know how to do the thing, why can't I do everything that you do? You know, I want all the, if I want this kind of integration in my Jewish life, then it needs to be integration as a woman too. It means that I don't want to have to leave part of myself at the door, or feel like when I come into the Jewish community, all these things that I've been working for in secular society are no longer expectations. Like, why? Why would there be that compartmentalization? I'm thinking of women like the women in Ezrat Nashim, which was an organization that was founded in 1971 by a group of very young Jewish women who were mostly coming out of the New York Chavura. My mom was one of them, actually. And they started really as a study group saying, oh, we want to learn more about Jewish women and Jewish women's history. And pretty much right away, they realized like, nope, we're not only going to be a study group. We're also going to be an activism group. And so one of the first things they did, they came from a variety of backgrounds, but many of them came from the conservative movement, had grown up in Ramah camps, had been well-educated. And they felt like they could set their sights on the conservative movement as a place to push change. They felt like some change was already happening in the Reform movement. The Orthodox world felt like way too hard to deal with. And so they wrote up this manifesto called Jewish Women Call for Change, and they crashed the convention of the Rabbinical Assembly, which is the rabbinic body of the conservative movement, in March of 1972. They just showed up there. And they handed out this manifesto. They put it in the packets. They hung up signs asking the women who were at this RA convention to come meet with them. Now, of course, who are the women who are at the RA convention in 1972? It's the wives of the rabbis. And they did meet with them. And in fact, my mom, I remember, told me that, and this I thought was one of the most moving things about this story, that when they came and met in this room, and the rabbinic assembly was actually remarkably welcoming to them. Like, actually, they got snowed in that weekend and they gave them a room to stay in and gave them space to meet or whatever. But when they met with the women, the Rebbetzins, the rabbi's wives, one of the women turned to them and said, "Where have you been? We've been waiting for you." Women who played a different role in Jewish life, you know, often a very, very important role in their communities, but a kind of supportive role. They knew that there was other change that needed to happen. They maybe knew they weren't the ones who were going to bring it, but they were ready to make room for other women to do a different kind, to play a different role. And they sparked a conversation, and within 11 years, which in historical time is not a lot of time, the Jewish Theological Seminary was voting to ordain women. So that was a, you know, one example of a change that was happening. There were other kind of countercultural groups that were also exploring some of these issues in different ways. But what I would say is that it was still a kind of liberal feminist perspective. They weren't yet addressing that question of, okay, once we are able to do these things, how is that going to just like totally change the picture? And it took a little more time for people to get to that place. And one of the first organizations that was really kind of taking that on was a group called B'not Eish. And I didn't say this about Ezrat Nashim, by the way, that Ezrat Nashim as a name for an organization was a play on words. Ezrat Nashim is traditionally the word that's used to describe the women's section of the synagogue. But it also means like the help of women, or sort of like the women's aid or something. You can translate it in different ways. B'not Eish means daughters of fire. This was a group that came together as a women's only group. Judith Plaskow who's a very important Jewish feminist theologian, was one of the founders. So there was some overlap between Ezrat Nashim membership and B'not Eish. But basically they were founded out of some conversations that happened, I believe, at a Chavura Institute. Conversations about, what do we want Judaism to look like? Like, how do we revolutionize Judaism to, you know, when we start to take women's perspectives into account, and when we start to challenge all these things we've received about who God is and what God looks like and what our ritual language should be, what happens when we bring our life experiences and perspectives to that? It actually is like totally revolutionary, and we need to really just like blow things open, and we can't do that sufficiently in conversation with men. We need to really take time and space to explore that. And so Benoit Asia is more of an example of that kind of second stage of saying, this is what actually the kind of transformation that's possible. And they compared what they were doing to Yavne, to, you know, the idea of like the origin story of rabbinic Judaism.
Comparing things to Yavne is right up our alley. And also there's been, you know, recent news about that. Maybe we'll link in the show notes for those curious about what I mean. So what you just brought up, especially you talked about the importance of women's only organizations and what happens to Judaism when women are given those entry points, and when women are allowed, I mean, allowed is the wrong word, but when women shape Judaism itself. And it leads me to, I think, both a challenging and an important question for women's organizations in general, but also for Jewish women's organizations right now, which is we're in a moment, and it's not new, but it's become more clear to us. The world is not only men and women.
Right.
And we have non-binary folks and many non-binary folks in Jewish life and many non-binary folks involved with sort of progressive Jewish projects, which both your organization, our organization, sort of consider ourselves part of that universe. And so given that we're in a moment, and it's not going to change anytime soon, thank God, where we're starting to center and empower folks who are non-binary, what does that mean for, I'm asking this not cynically or like with, as an attack, like I'm genuinely curious, like how does a project like Jewish Women's Archive orient to that? In what ways are non-binary folks part of the Jewish Women's Archive story? In what ways does it maybe add new layers to the work of the Jewish Women's Archive? In what ways is it a separate project? For like, I'm curious how you're orienting to these kinds of questions, with the understanding, of course, that I'm sure it's evolving, and that's work that all of us are in the midst of over the years, over the decades.
Yeah, I sort of sometimes joke that you know, it used to be that the hard part of our name to grapple with was the archive part, because we weren't really an archive, and archive was a kind of unstable term in the way we were using it. And then we also felt like Jewish was kind of an unstable term, because we have a really inclusive notion of who is a Jew, and we don't feel like our job is to be defining that. So we're very inclusive on that front. And now women also is an unstable category. So pretty much our whole name is just like out there floating, being interrogated, which is...
Who needs stable,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. I always say, like, it's a lot of fun on an intellectual level, like, and on a content level, and it's sometimes hard to raise money around, but, you know, that's how it goes. Sure. Like, this is a huge and very interesting and exciting challenge, I think, for Jewish women's organizations. And by the way, I wouldn't say that... I don't think of JWA as a Jewish women's organization. I think of us as a communal organization that centers women's stories, because I don't want us to... You know, I don't want people to think like, oh, JWA, that's for women. Like, you know, I think we're for everybody. In terms of who we include, you know, we've been going through this in terms of, we're in the midst of doing a big expansion project of our encyclopedia. And we are including non-binary people who would want to be included. So I think a lot of this needs to be kind of self-defined, like people who see themselves sort of the way we think about Jewishness in the context of our archive, like people who see themselves as belonging in this community, belong in this community. We certainly, in terms of our analysis, are really thinking a lot about, well, what does gender mean? What does it mean to be a woman? And so those conversations are conversations that are for everybody and for people of all genders, but also really need the input of non-binary people. And my feeling is that, like, women's organizations are still really necessary, sometimes just for people who are female identified. Sometimes women and non-binary people have a lot to do together that is really important. And I think it's going to be a constant process of figuring out what and really articulating well what the goals are of different communities and different gatherings, and where you know, where it makes sense to be as expansive as possible, and where there needs to be sort of tighter definitions for particular, to explore particular issues. And I think that there will be, you know, similar also to how now we're, like, I think many communities are thinking about which conversations are about race are really important for people of all races to have, and when is it important for there to be people of color who are having conversations by themselves, and when is it important for white people to have conversations by themselves. And, you know, so I think it's a similar question around some of that.
Thank you so much, Judith Rosenbaum, for joining us. This has been such a fantastic conversation. We're always really excited to talk with you. And before we go, huge shouts to the Quarantine Book Talks that we're thrilled to be partnering with you on. For folks who want more from JWA, that's a great pathway to interact with some amazing, amazing Jewish women's authors and with Judith Rosenbaum herself, who is the host. So thank you for joining us. And it's been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you so much. This was really great. And we love partnering with you guys.
And thanks, of course, to all of you out there listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And we hope that you'll tune in to the remainder of this series on Jewish women, both in history and today. So thanks again. And we want to close out this episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com or jewishlive.org. Third, you can go to our Twitter feed, which is at Judaism Unbound. You can check out our Instagram, also Judaism Unbound. And last but not least, you can always email us, dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we'd like to make is that we really deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you're able to send our way, especially as we turn the page on a new year on the Jewish calendar. So if you want to do that, you can send us a donation either on a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.